Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, September the 25th, 1995. This evening in the Village Center, we're going to be listening in on the Holden Theological Conference, sponsored by the Lutheran Education Network and Support. Tonight, Session 2, The Future Shape of the Church, being led by Dr. Lull. Let's listen in.
We have one introduction that we want to make right now. We have a visiting guest from El Salvador, and I've asked Bishop David Wohl to introduce him to you.
I'd like to ask Pastor Walter Byres from the Lutheran Church in El Salvador to stand and be recognized and to let you know that he not only represents an international flavor to this, but our partnership with that church. Many of you know that church had its roots with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, that its bishop, Medardo Gomez, was trained in one of those seminaries. Pastor Byres is on the staff and works very closely with Bishop Gomez as in charge of the sister parish program from that church and our churches here. And many of you would like to have an opportunity to visit with Walter, and I hope that you will have that chance. There will be an announcement tomorrow about when some time may be set aside. But Walter, we welcome you and ask God's peace on you and your church.
Thank you for singing with me. I went to seminary in part and became a pastor because I wanted to choose the hymns. And except in my own classes, I rarely get the chance anymore, so it was fun to slip one in that I've been in the mood to sing. Did you know you can sing a communion hymn when you're not having communion? It's amazing what's possible. I recommend Luther on Christian freedom. You'd be surprised what you can do. I'll talk to you about the lectionary if you have problems there, too. I want to talk with you tonight about the future of the church, but first a commercial. For the GTU Summer School in general, with 81-week courses and a week in the Bay Area in the summer can be pleasant. I know it's not to everyone's liking, but many have found it enjoyable. And an invitation some year, when it suits your schedule, to come down and do the Luther Seminar with a group of us who I've now committed myself that as long as I'm standing for the foreseeable future, every summer I will do a one-week Luther course. We've done it 2 years and have had a wonderful time. And it's partly a chance to get back in and look, if you haven't worked on Luther for a while, to look at some segment of his thinking more intensively. That the week for next year will be August 2nd through 6th. I'm on sabbatical for a couple of months, so I have to put it a little later in the summer. And the topic will be the Reformation in Wittenberg, 1521 to 25. We want to look at just one segment of Luther's life and look very much at Luther, the pastor working with change in the church. I think it's such good stuff. And we'll try to read both some of the old favorites, renew what's there, but read some documents that are less familiar, letters, a little sense of the social history of the time. So come see us at some point. If that doesn't work for you, we'll keep offering them, and sooner or later hope to get many of you down there. We've had about 30-plus folks, mostly parish pastors, nice mix of people from around the country, and some good friendships get developed in the course of this study. Now, I want to talk tonight about the future of the church, and when I said around the table after dinner, what would I know about it, there was kind of nervous laughter, which is right, because what would I know about it? We all need to start this kind of discussion with a bow in the direction of St. Paul, who speaks for all of us when he says, "We see in the glass darkly." And if anybody really can tell you much about the future of the church, I'd hang on to my wallet at that point. On the other hand, God's given us responsibility, and most of us are alive from the neck up at this point, and we certainly see some things in the present that are likely to have some implication for the future. So if we can all make appropriate disclaimers and do this in a kind of fun way, Maybe we can help each other both worry a bit, because that's part of it, to get some of those worries out and name what some of those things are, but then also to get hopeful about what some of the positive possibilities would be. I'm going to spend a lot of the time tonight telling you what I think and hope the future of the church is. I could give you more nightmarish predictions. I'm a real good worrier. Most teaching theologians are. I think that wouldn't be much fun, because you're mostly pretty good worriers too. Most parish bishops are very good worriers in my experience. Most parish pastors, most lay people have got a lot to worry about, because they sit on the far end of all this stuff that we produce. But let me begin to enter into this topic by saying that the doctrine of the church and the understanding of the church has really dominated much theological discussion for the last 40 years. I would say really particularly in the period since Vatican II and the kind of new ecumenical possibilities that opened up. We've all been thinking about what's the nature of Christian community. And I'd like to begin by naming some of the problems by saying I think there are four shadows over this discussion that give us a certain degree of sadness when we talk about it. I don't want to dwell on these, but I'd like to name them and see if they are indeed problems for you as well. I think the first sadness I was really referring to in my speech earlier today, and that is we seem to be at some kind of end of Christendom, some kind of end of some long centuries of continuity, of one kind of role for the church, and there's going to be something on ahead, and it may be great, but it doesn't look like it initially. So an awful lot of Lutherans in North America are stuck in nostalgia at this point, which is very significant and important and not to be laughed at, but a very dangerous mode of being, because most of us remember dishonestly. I think we're wanting back all the features of what was great in the past without remembering some things that weren't so great that came with it. I was in Pittsburgh Saturday night and I went to church there, wonderful short spoken service. I complain a lot about services at my parish being too long, so 30 minutes spoken, that was fine. And I went out to dinner with the pastor, a woman who's a former student, and her husband, who's pastor of a neighboring congregation. I haven't seen them for a while. I said, "How's it going?" And we spent most of the evening talking about my ministry and their ministry and what's happening. And finally, they said, "Actually, these little struggling blue-collar communities in Pittsburgh, they're doing some remarkable things, but they just can't let go of how many more folks there were there a generation ago. They can't take any pleasure in what they're doing now because these churches are full of ghosts." And I thought of my own home church, St. John's Lutheran Church in Fremont, Ohio, with 1,200 members and life and vitality, but they used to have 3,000. And so much of the time they can only be depressed about why didn't that last, and can only see a time of enormous vitality and generous mission support for the life of the church as a kind of last gasp, rather than the next stage of what God had led them into. My sisters and I are very good at conjuring up nostalgia for that past, growing up in one of those huge congregations where it looks like your team is winning. My wife, who did not share that experience, who was a Southern Methodist by background, will point out from time to time how surprising it is that the kingdom of God would have peaked in Fremont, Ohio in about 1959. And we laugh as you do and realize that we've gotten very selective. But I mention this not because it's an important feature of the Lowell family, but I bet that's around. If you don't have it, I bet a lot of people that you work with do. And we're enormously tempted then by what I would call restorationist leadership that tells us if we just do X or Y or Z, we can have it all back. Maybe so, but I don't think so. That's my first thing about the future of the church. There's a kind of era that's coming to an end, whether we want to talk about secularization, whether we want to talk about Lutheran market share, whether we want to talk about mainline to sideline, whatever it would be. We're in a kind of transitional time where a lot of us can remember another time, and we're not sure we bought into going with God on the adventure of what's coming next. Secondly, I have to say my own heart is heavy tonight with discouragement of just how much trouble we've seen in the church in our own lifetime. I mean, isn't this a hard one to get up for? Partly because we're not talking about the church in some abstract sense, but we're talking about the actual religious communities that we know. My own family has had a number of beloved pastors out of the ministry for gross misconduct, sexual and financial. So many wonderful former students have bit the dust. And which of us could look at these things and not say, there but for the grace of God go I. However appropriate the disciplinary standards that are now before us may be, however much we brought them upon ourselves, there's a kind of sadness to this. There's a kind of sadness for me, having worked on the Human Sexuality Consulting Panel, at how much we really dislike each other when we really get down to it. I read 6 of the 90 volumes of communication that came in from all of you about the human sexuality document. Wow. Talk about pornographic literature. The anger, the bitterness, the distrust. I mean, that's there, and it's subsided for now. But it gave us a picture of something of what's there, and it's inside us too. It's not there in someone else. We've got our disappointments in the church, and we've had our quarrels. How many congregations that I talked to you about that you're currently serving are in some kind of painful transition because people in the Christian community couldn't get along with each other? How much energy we've wasted from the mission task and the ELCA in our theological publications, taking shots at each other. You know, for positions that on the great cosmic scheme of things aren't more than about 4 inches apart from one another. I think we need to have some prayers of confession for the sadness that we have, for the trouble that we've had, and for the responsibility that all of us have had. I don't mean to say everybody's equally at fault, but I think we've all played our own part in giving way, in letting our anxieties about the church and about the changes that are coming give way to the kind of frustration where angry words are spoken and bitterness comes out, and then it's so hard to put it back in the bottle once it's there. One of the things I certainly don't endorse, if it was ever a slogan in Berkeley, is just get all your feelings out and everything will be fine. I wish Luther had expressed a few fewer of his feelings. It'd be less embarrassing to have to teach some of his documents. Bonhoeffer is better on this. There's a ministry of keeping your mouth shut. A ministry of just letting a certain issue pass, because while you may be mad about it, it's only going to escalate the conflict for you to weigh in with your own frustrations. A third shadow has to do with the fact that we've never in 500 years of Lutheranism solved the problem of authority in our church. And I don't propose to do that tonight. What a long Holden Village conference that would be. Maybe it can't be solved in Lutheranism. Partly our best stuff is our critique of what the wrong kind of authority is. And whenever we see a kind of tyrannical, hierarchical authority in the church, then our real founding documents ring true. We've been much less good at finding ways to be the church that allow us to adjudicate our decisions and our disputes with one another. And our floundering around in the sexuality study said to me at least as much about that as it did about our confusions about human sexuality. We don't really trust much of anybody. We give, in some ways, final authority to the churchwide assembly. If you've been to one of those, it's a lot of very, very fine people working very hard but not allowed to do much. It's not set up for them hardly to express an opinion at all, other than yes or no on reports that are basically pre-submitted. Our bishops sit on all the fault lines of the church, but we've largely to date structured the church in such a way as to not let them even tell us what they're thinking collectively, because somebody thinks that would be an abuse of power. We're floundering on this, and it isn't surprising then that we can easily get tempted into a kind of what I'd call non-separating congregationalism. The real danger before the ELCA is not that I think thousands of congregations are going to leave, but that you just lose interest in our connectional life. because we really have, it's a kind of unfinished part of the Reformation, frankly. Sometimes in the early years of the Reformation, the Wittenberg faculty for a century or two was able to be helpful. I don't know that we as theological faculties have been much help in these recent things. I mean, I'm not trying to put down what we try to do for the church, but I think we're as divided and confused on many of these issues, and certainly it is not the case, as one candidate for bishop of the church said, that if we just gave the issue of sexuality to the seminary faculties, they'd be able to sort it out. I thought this was from a fine presenter, but I thought the single worst answer given in all of those discussions. But now I want to name the fourth shadow, which is, or the fourth shadow, which is maybe one of the most significant for the discussion we want to have tonight. And that is, folks, I think we're really in a kind of ecumenical Cold War situation right now, or at least in a kind of ecumenical deep freeze in comparison to where we were a generation ago. So much of our enthusiasm for the church. I mean, in the mid-60s, late-60s, we were at the end of the kind of enormous church growth, mission-building boom that had lasted all through the 50s and into the 60s. But we got a kind of second wind, partly from the wonderful gift of Vatican II and the opening up of conversations and possibilities of divided Christendom coming back together that just were amazing. I mean, how Lutherans moved on liturgical and social and other matters, partly spurred by the fact that suddenly we were in conversation with all sorts of folks. Well, you know, we weren't able to consummate our Lutheran romance with each other. Nobody wants to spoil the party here and belabor that, but we ought to say that's one of the shadows. And certainly now, and I think one has to say largely, because of the very different direction from the Roman Catholic Church, we're in a very different period. I don't mean that it's over. A lot of the most exciting things that are going on ecumenically are going on at the local level, and we've made gains that aren't going to go away. We're certainly not back before where we were when all the dialogue started. But I think it has to be said that a lot of us, particularly the older half of the group that's here, thought we'd make more progress on that than we've been able to. And now we're kind of wondering, facing 1997 and the ELCA, if we're going to be able to salvage much of anything, or if we're so internally divided about what we want and what we think of other people that little will happen. The positive balancing those four problems is an enormous positive opportunity that may scare us even more than the shadows do. And that is, suddenly almost everybody understands that it's not business as usual, but that we are confronting an enormous mission challenge. We're living as small, and in some ways smaller and smaller, Christian communities, surrounded by a culture of folks who are spiritually hungry but deeply distrustful of organized religion, including churches like our own. We've got a tremendous opportunity with unchurched in America, but let's not kid ourselves, folks. Most of the unchurched were previously churched, and they've got deep scar tissue from what happened before. Although we do have now, particularly in the parts of the country where most of us live, whole generations of folks growing up who've been scarcely touched by Christianity at all. That's a wonderful opportunity, but I'm skeptical that much of our congregational life or ministry is really set up in a way to know what to do with such folks if they did show up, which I guess, lucky for us, they don't very often. But what would we do if they did? Professor Carl Donfried of Smith College has been saying for the last 20 years, how many Lutheran congregations are ready when somebody comes in off the streets and says, I'd like to learn about being a Christian? Oh, we're pretty good at taking people from other denominations and retooling them as Lutherans, especially if they marry one, and we can do a lot of this, you know, right there in the home. But there's this kind of powerful mission challenge before us. And gee, it's not just that we're shy Lutherans, folks. This is not something that is very deeply written in our heritage, particularly in the founding part of it. If you go back and study the religious movements of the 16th century, you have to really scramble and in some ways falsify the evidence to find anything about mission in Luther's writings or in the Book of Concord at all. It's the real and ultimate Lutheran whole. Now, there's a remedy for this. We'll get to that in a minute. But I think we just have to say it isn't just that we're too middle class, are not very good, and it isn't our way of doing things. John Gerhard, a great Lutheran theologian of the 17th century, argued that mission was a sin. Because God had offered to all the nations in the first century the gospel, and if they didn't accept it, then tough luck. Well, I have to say not too far from where some of us would be. Now, obviously, there's a remedy to this because the source for mission comes from the Bible itself, comes from the Word of God itself. But see, we got to back up one step beyond what we're used to, and we got to do things like read the book of Acts and preach on it. And by the way, all the wrong stuff is in the lectionary for this. I don't think Peter's sermon on Pentecost or these other long-winded things are the way you get at it. But in the book of Acts is at least one account of the early missionary activity and enthusiasm, and by the way, many mistakes and failures of the early church. There'd be help there. Paul's letters, when they're read as documents in the context of mission, have a quite different ring to them than when we read them as dogmatic treatises written by a German university professor. There are ways to go, but I want to say this mission challenge, which ought to be the joy of this gathering and which we're trying to pick up, is in some ways the biggest shadow of them all, because we don't know whether we can do it. Our resistance is so high and our sense of potential failure is so great. And I think this ought to be one of the places where a group like this could come together, clergy and lay, ELCA and LCMS, the different roles that we play in the church, and really have a solemn oath and covenant and have a common front that we care about this. And that this is an issue of overriding importance, and that means we're not going to wait for it to happen, wait for somebody else to do it, but we're going to start preaching about it and praying about it and witnessing ourselves to our faith and what this means. I mean, forget about other people doing it if the leadership group can't do it itself. I think there's possibility here, but I'm still really under my area of concern. But let's turn this in a more positive direction. What could we could list some fears about the church's future, and we've really been doing it, particularly if any of these things are extended on up. But let's talk about what some hopeful things might be. I'd like to put before you my vision of what some of my, and I hope the hopes are realistic. It's not, if you will, it's my hopes and not my dreams for the church or my fantasies for the church. What are some things that could really happen in the next couple of decades that would lead us to recognizable continuity with where we are and yet a different sort of feel that surely Christianity will have in the 21st century? I want to try 9 things briefly and see what your own list is, see what you'd have on them. First of all, I hope and believe that a Lutheran church in the future, if God wills that there be such, will be a community that more than ever is a place where the grace of God shines through unambiguously as the fundamental message. I hope that and I pray for that because I don't think we have an excessive number of religious communities in America that err on the side of grace. The casualties of Christianity that I meet are, for in large measure, people who've given up because they ran into legalistic Christianity, or authoritarian Christianity, which worked for a while but was not very helpful when the bottom fell out in their own lives. I see Roman Catholics for whom this is true. I see ex-evangelicals and fundamentalists for whom this is true. I see victims of the kind of legalism of mainstream, mainline political correctness churches, but I have to say a fair percentage of those casualties are former Lutherans who heard in our midst not the gospel as the final word, but so much emphasis on law at the beginning and not taking advantage of the gospel at the end, that the good news was a kind of brief formal moment lost between the preparation for it and the worry that nobody engage in cheap grace. Gerhard Fruedi said a long time ago, the solution to cheap grace was not to raise the price a little. And I really think that's what we've been guilty of. If it's worth having a Lutheran church in the future, and I'm voting yes on that, it's worth it that we not be just one other church with a message indistinguishable from everyone else, but that it's worth going on because there needs to be a community, especially when we look at all these casualties, all the people that have dropped out of Christianity. There needs to be a community in which grace abounds and in which the message and the life of the community has grace as its leading theme. For that to happen, I come to a second hope, which is that Lutherans would come to learn from Luther to use all the means of grace rather than just one or two. In one of my favorite passages from Luther in the Schmalkald Articles, late in his life, relatively late in his writing certainly, 1537, Luther says about the gospel, the amazing thing is that God brings the good news to us in more than one way. It's as if Luther understands fully and completely what an unlikely countercultural message the good news is. And so he says the gospel comes to us, of course, through the word, written and studied and preached, but also through baptism, through the Lord's Supper, through confession and absolution, and through the mutual conversation and consolation of brothers and sisters. I don't think it's an exhaustive list. I don't think Luther thinks it is. One could add more to it. But it's at least a minimal list of what ought to be there. And what I observe as I travel around the church is how fragmentary we are. We've got one or two of these things, and then the others are kind of done in a cursory way, but not with any energy behind them. I'm going to say something about freedom for worship in a minute, but I don't think in a Lutheran church that's worth bothering to try to lead into the new century, a church where sacraments are optional if they work well with market research, is really anything that has any right to bear the Lutheran name. That's not a recipe for a particular way to do it. I mean, there's the mission challenge to figure out what liturgical and sacramental ministry is in our own time. It's high time some of us learn from some of our neighbors about the mutual conversation and consolation. I do not believe, folks, participation in committee meetings is anything but a backhand way of getting at that. And yet I find so many of our congregations that still have not found the energy or the cleverness to organize ways in which small groups of Christians can come together and talk about their faith and pray with one another and be strengthened. Let's use it all. For heaven's sakes, let's not replace preaching with the sacraments and think that that's any great advance. I talked about that fundamental charismatic hole this afternoon. That will have to be there. But preaching, what Luther knows something here we need to learn. Preaching of God's good news for us will be most effective when we don't make all of it depend on the sermon, but when these various forms of the means of grace work together. Sometimes it is only through the comforting work or the embrace of a brother or sister that I am able to hear the good news. But sometimes I need to hear it in the more formal, traditional, preached way. Sometimes the sacraments leave me cold, and I have gone up to communion and gone back to my seat with my mind on so many other things that I'm surprised we've already had communion. And it's true for you too. Sometimes even when you're presiding. And other times, I am so deeply and powerfully moved that God would come to us in this intimate way, and that this community of people who ought to have nothing to do with one another come together with their hands stretched out, that it speaks to me in a way that very few sermons are able to do. Let's use it all. But let's use it in connection with a third prediction about the future of the church, which is that if we are shrewd, we will rediscover the real diversity in worship, which is our heritage and is not forbidden. Students at my seminary, most of the entering ones, are stuck in a course with me this semester called Lutheran Lutheranism. I figure you might as well get to know the dean right away, and even more to the point, you might as well get to know Luther right away. And we will do on Thursday, when I'm back there with them and not here with you, where in many ways I'd rather be, we'll read Luther's sermons when he came back to Wittenberg to clean up the mess, and we'll then read Luther's first proposals for how to reform worship. And someone will say, He says it doesn't have to be the same every place. Now, is this a misprint? And I have to say, no, he really means it. He was not an employee of Augsburg Publishing, GIA, or any other company. Now, there's a lot to be said in behalf of having forms of Lutheran worship that are recognizable, that we can move back and forth from community to community. I'm not trying to just throw that away. And let's all do our own thing. I don't think most of us are clever enough to do our own thing at that level. And I certainly feel with Luther that the heritage of earlier centuries is something to build on and not something to be dismissive of. But he had a wonderful sense that would help us right now, that there ought to be local traditions as well. And I wonder if the next stage of our liturgy is not to throw it all out and start over, but to find ways to do some adapting of that more formal process that we had to go through as we were learning the Lutheran Book of Worship, to find ways to make that fit in our own particular context. It was a kind of one garment fits all product. And we know, as we look around at body types here, that's a very dangerous kind of concept to have. I wonder if we couldn't do some wonderful tailoring and some adventuring and some helping one another to say, this is going great with us. Does it seem to make sense to you? Or are we just pandering to the most base things that people want? I think we need to know, particularly in the area of music, the freedom that's before us. And I greet with enormous enthusiasm with one voice. Not that it's the only thing like this, but that the Lutheran Church would actually be putting out a both and product with some of the great contemporary things and some old gospel hymns that we were far too snobby to allow to sneak their way into the LBW. It's a kind of act of repentance and overdue. To go back to my home congregation for a minute, I won't say all 1,800 have left over the selection of hymns, but there's no question that in this blue-collar community, moving the liturgical standards up three or four notches was very pleasing to a certain elite group of leaders and made absolutely no sense to an awful lot of the people who do not listen to Bach on their CD players when they're not in church, but love country and Western music. We couldn't sing a gospel hymn. No, that's really wrong. That's what others do, and we thank God every day that we're not like them. It's particularly in hymnody, it seems to me, that we've got some real room to do the old and the new together, to have Matthew's sense of the wise scribe who knows how to mix it up. I sure hope my comments or other people's comments about With One Voice doesn't mean now I've got to go places and that's all we use. It's going to be kind of a battle between LBW only and that only. I think most of us are dexterous enough to use two books. And really, what we'd be doing to people, not to sing the great classic hymns, but please not all of them all the time. Something people could love and feel at home with at the same time we're learning some things that are new. A fourth hope for the future is that we will help people with their spirituality and not spend a long time telling them that Lutherans don't believe in spirituality and it's the wrong word and shame on them and don't go to Barnes & Noble and Borders bookshelves. We've got people who are really hungry now. And Jesus says, when children are hungry, parents offer bread and not a stone. I don't know about bread, but there's sure a lot of junk food out there that's being offered. If people get benefit from it, well and good. I don't find the typical Lutheran congregation really having thought this through and offering opportunities right there on the spot for people to learn to pray and some of these other spiritual disciplines that don't come naturally, that are so very countercultural in this secularized society. Obviously, one size won't fit all here either. And there'll be sub-pieties within our congregations, and we'll have to adjust to the fact that what really turns some people on makes others rush outside the door. But I think we're going to live lonelier lives as Christians in the 21st century. I think if you think there's little social reinforcement now, I suspect there'll be even less. The wise church would be the one that then did something intentional about that, instead of expecting the culture itself to provide spiritual nourishment. we'd be more intentional about this. It can't, by the way, all be done in 1 hour on Sunday morning. I mean, that's some of the overload we have, too. We're trying to do spirituality and parish announcements and program promotion and remedial Christian education and social issues and praise God and be recipients and hear the word all in 1 hour. I mean, what, people have migraine headaches from that kind of thing. We've got to find some ways to be honest that Christian commitment is probably going to mean more than an hour a week. And then our worship can become lighter and more joyful because we're not trying to pack all these things into a captive audience. Fifth, I think and hope and pray that the Lutheran Church of the future will be one that does rediscover mission and evangelism, but is faithful enough to its own tradition of justification by faith in the theology of the cross, that it practices what we have almost never seen in North America, which is non-anxious evangelism. Most evangelism that I see, including Lutheran evangelism, is driven by one of two sets of anxieties. Either they're going to be damned unless we get them, so it's for their own good. You laugh because that doesn't really do much. We wouldn't want to deny it, but it doesn't really grab us at the gut, does it? I'm supposed to do the Hein Fry lectures next year at four seminaries on whether the church is necessary for salvation. I think hardly anybody's worried about that, except maybe people in Chicago who gave me the assignment. I think the more interesting question to address would be, is salvation necessary for the church? I'm not trying to undercut a very deep and serious theological thing here, but I'm saying when most of us try to lead with that, it isn't really who we are theologically. And there's a kind of phoniness to it, and it very quickly runs out of gas, or we turn the evangelism effort over to the few surviving old-fashioned pietists in our congregation, and they have trouble connecting with the sorts of visitors who are coming. That's one kind of anxiety, but there's another kind that I find more among ELCA Lutherans, and that's market share anxiety. We've got to do evangelism because we might slip below 5 million, and how could we then show our face? Let me tell you something reassuring about that. We might not have 5 million now, if that's what you're worried about. I've never, in 20 years of seminary teaching, I've never had a student call back and say, the amazing thing is there are more people on the rolls here. There are more people in this congregation than there are on the rolls. Let's just say 5+ million is a very rough guess. It might be a little bit like elections in Cook County, and we might be counting, in the old words of the creed, the quick and the dead together, at least in some places. I'm very interested in the expansion and growth of the Christian community, but I gotta say to you, brothers and sisters, there's nothing in Holy Scripture or the Lutheran Confessions or any sensible document that tells us for all time what God will guarantee as the Lutheran market share if we will only do our part. It might be our task in the next century to have to run real hard to collapse more slowly. That a little depressing? Well, we ought to talk about these things. I mean, I'd like to get to the point at these events where we could say, hey, we're in this for the long haul. And we don't know what it's going to be. It may be small, struggling Christian communities. It may be a lot of Lutheran house churches here in the Northwest 50 years from now. Are you ready to throw in the towel and say, well, that's the end of the whole thing? Or could we be open to the possibility that might be exactly the path on which God is setting us? This is certainly not a recipe for defeat, but it's a recipe to say, before you say to others, come and see, get clear in your mind about what your motives are. And to go out and do evangelism because we don't have enough in the choir, there aren't enough to pay the bills, is, I think, not a very profound statement of the gospel. I think we got to get back in touch with justification, which gives us that non-anxious way to approach our neighbor, and with the theology of the cross that tells us success is hidden in the judgment of God. And woe to us if we're too puffed up when we're doing well, and woe to us if we're too despairing when things seem to go against us. The promise of God, the promise of the risen Christ, is to be with us always in our mission ventures, even to the close of the age. And we're not there yet. For this to happen, a sixth feature of the Church of the Future would have to be that everybody would lighten up a little bit, including me. I have to say that because I think I'm just as anxious as any of you are and full of agendas on which I will not compromise under any circumstances. And it's the human thing, and some of us are extremely good at selling out our demands and kind of stating our demands and intimidating other people with it. The problem I have with it as a historian is it doesn't sound like the church in mission. Seems to me the church in mission always has to take risks. And if you'll go back and read and study and preach on the book of Acts, which I really wish you do, you'll find there's just bloody conflict all the time about who's getting away with what and who's doing what. And if there isn't, you're probably not doing anything. A great deal of what's before us now is to center not in common structure or common ethos or even absolutely common liturgy, which is the way all the other churches in America are structured, not in hierarchical teaching authority, which we would not accept for a minute, even though we fantasize about how nice, well, we fantasize about having it if we're it. But the minute somebody else is in hierarchical teaching authority, we'll start the Reformation all over again. We've got to recenter the Lutheran Church if we're going to go on around a message. And that commonality of the message then allows us to compromise on some of the means and some of the techniques and some of the secondary matters, as important as they may turn out to be. We're just going to need less structure, folks. We're going to need lighter gear if we're going to undertake this. Do you know the old Latin word for baggage? Impedimentum. Well, I love a lot of my baggage. I was real tense until that suitcase arrived. Fortunately, I was on the first boat, on the first truck, so we can draw whatever conclusions we want from that. But we're structured not for a mission time, but for a kind of settled Christendom time right now. And we got to think this one through carefully. The answer is never to throw structure overboard, because then it comes back with a vengeance. Luther learned that in Wittenberg when he was away and when he came back. That's why it's so instructive to go back and look at some of those struggles. We'll need order and we'll need structure, but all of us are going to have to say, for the sake of mission, I put up with my brother or sister who does X, which I don't like, because it's an experiment under the presidency of the Holy Spirit that's worth doing. And I have enough trust in her or his passion for the gospel that I don't have to rule all the details of what's going on there. More about structure in a few minutes. I think our public witness, our witness to God's care for the suffering and God's concern with justice, has been one of the glories of the Lutheran Church in the late 20th century. Going back to the kind of wonderful way that we were involved in war relief after World War II, it was a major occasion for getting the level of agreement we got between the ELCA and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. It was really the crisis of World War II that taught us at least some ways that we could work together. A wonderful period in the 60s and 70s and 80s in which churches were making social statements that were very helpful, very profound. Maybe not perfect, some of them could be faulted in retrospect, but we learned how to do it in that period. It was said about us by a lot of our ecumenical neighbors that we didn't have it in us to do Lutheran ethics. And our consciences bothered us because we had seen the complicity of the church in Germany under Hitler, for example, and we knew in the Vietnam War and the racial crisis that we had to say something, as hard as it would be. And we learned some lessons. I think now we got to re-find our way here. It's not a question of stopping doing it. Because if, as I suggested in the first lecture, the gospel is not an engine for social change, but the gospel inevitably leads people to care about suffering in the world, they'll need to continue to be powerful witness. But I tell you, brothers and sisters, I've come to the point where I'm not interested in a single additional long statement on any subject whatsoever for at least a decade, maybe 50 years. I just think somehow we've gotten in competition with the Catholic bishops and the Methodists and everybody else in an unhelpful way. Let me tell you Lull's law of social statements: less is more. It's really stolen from Larry Rasmussen at the Reforming the Church Conference, but I think it's right on. And I think we might get a fair amount of agreement across conservative, liberal, moderate lines on this. I also think, even more fundamentally, if we're thinking about the local Christian community, the witness we're going to make to the love of God in a world where people are suffering is more what we do than what we say. And we have to be helping one another think, what are places where we can be that kind of world-affirming sect that we talked about, that close-knit community that does not live turned in on itself but comes together to be strengthened for our outreach and loving service to the world? We've got to find signs. We've got to find things that we can do that don't so much teach by our statements, that's so Lutheran to want to do that, to produce a long document, but teach by the example of what we're able to do. I don't think we can say anymore as Lutherans to the military, you know, in our theology, when we consider very carefully law and gospel and two, but the ELCA said this, Missouri didn't, but I'll just give it as an example. I don't think we can say anymore to the military, you really need to welcome gays and lesbians, that's a wonderful thing, but don't ask us to do it in the church. See the problem with that? I mean, there might be, I could make, if I had to, I could make the theological argument in relation to two kingdoms about why you might say that. I just don't think it's a very credible posture for a Christian community to do. We can't do it, but you do it, because justice requires you to do it, but we don't live under justice. I wonder what we do live under in the church. Maybe we can't welcome gays and lesbians, but then let's not be telling other people what they're supposed to do, or let's see if we could. And then we might have something credible to say. Or for another example that just haunts me at this point, the rage against illegal immigrants. How dare most Lutherans participate in this? How legal do you think it was in many cases for our forebears? Those of us who came from Northern Europe, my great-grandfather came to me in a dream and said, "You better speak up on this one, Timothy. How can a church that is so heavily made up of immigrants who were relatively well treated when they came here now participate in this kind of rage against illegal immigrants?" I think maybe some of our churches need to be places where there's some social services given if the greater society won't do it. And given not as an act of defiance. I mean, we understand the anxieties. We understand the need to structure things. We understand the need for law and order. We understand it all too well in the Lutheran Church, as a matter of fact. But just to say, you know, as much as that may be where the government's going, our own hearts push us in another direction. We remember who we were, not only our family stories, but we remember 1 Peter. Once we were no people, but now we are God's people. Could we talk less and do more? Could we have a witness that had a little more to do with our walk and less with the kind of sort of advice that we'd like to give to others? In terms of structure, I think we are going to have to take up a challenge that the Reformation has never been able to face. And that would be the structural implications of Jesus' remarkable speech to the disciples, that farewell discourse in John 13 through 17. Jesus says in that speech in a chapter that I didn't note down, and I can't remember which one it is, but I know he says it there, "I no longer call you servants, but I call you my friends." Servant doesn't know what the master is doing, but the friends know. One of the tasks I'd like to work on in the next decade is thinking out the structural implications of that. We're going to have structure and order. We're going to have offices. I think as things get worse, we're going to need bishops more than we've ever needed them. But how do we have a structure? How do we have pastors and diaconal ministers and bishops and theologians and all kinds of things, deacons and congregations and council members and things like that? How do we have one that doesn't do essential violence to that bottom line for the Christian community, that what Jesus has called us to is not to lord it over one another in the way that the leaders of the nations do, but to try to develop a community that has about it something of the nature of how friends would work with one another? It's a very great challenge. I'll get back to you in 10 years and see if I find anything on this subject. But it just seems to me, when we get around to structure, all of a sudden the world has all the best lines. And all of a sudden, we're rather too quickly ready to throw overboard some of the deeper gospel challenges, to do our own life in a way that is not conformed to this world, but transformed by the gospel. Finally, let me make a very radical suggestion and prediction. Lutheran mission will work if and when... No, Lutheran mission will be enhanced if and when local Lutheran congregations would be willing to work together on it rather than as rival institutions. Now, I don't think I'm naive about self-interest. I've taught ethics. I know it's a fallen world. I know that we all care for our own more than we care for others. But have we sat down, folks, and scratched the surface on this? I mean, there's a great middle ground between sort of, you know, a conference meeting once a year and armed hostility other than that, and saying that we're all going to bear each other's burdens and woes and that kind of, that's not going to happen for a long time either. But I wonder if we've taken some of the minimal first steps that we might be able to do in most places to work together. Have the pastors in some neighboring congregations sat down and helped one another determine what gifts each of them have that might be used in some useful way, not just for that one congregation, but for a group of neighboring congregations? Most places that I know, there's somebody who is really good at Bible study. Or a couple who are really good at Bible study, but they do it in different ways or about different parts of the Bible. I mean, I can't tell you how to do it, folks, and it'd be wrong to do it. It would inhibit mission if I did it. But I just don't think we've ever gotten around to level one brainstorming on this. And level one brainstorming is certainly not saying we dismantle congregations and all work together or something like that. But it's to say, gee, if we're congregations and missions, aren't there some ways that we could work together? Aren't there some cutting edge places that we could really help each other? Of course, see, we've been conformed to this world, and this world believes in zero sum solutions and that there's not enough to go around. I was so impressed once when I went to a very, very Lutheran but very evangelical, enthusiastic evangelism conference in Phoenix in one of those big churches that people used to dislike before they got to disliking other churches that are even bigger. And the pastor of this church said, there's so many unchurched in America, we ought to be able to work together. There's really enough to go around. I don't know. I really think more of our common life in a synod, in a conference, needs to go to working on this. Could we help each other a little? Even if the world still is heavily upon us, and in the end we're going to have our own budgets and our own employees and be much happier about our own successes than those of others and bleed much more about the failures that we have and be mildly indifferent to those of other people. Let me conclude with a few comments on the future of ecumenism. One thing I'm not going to do, which I think would spoil the fun of the next 2 years, is tell you how to all vote in 1997. If you go to the churchwide assembly, A, I don't, well, I know I'm not going, but B, I don't know how to vote yet either. I think particularly under our new presiding bishop, who's such a distinguished ecumenist, and who knows how far behind the times we are in local discussions of this, I think there'll be a burst of energy, and I think we'll have good discussions. Whether the documents that are before us are a good idea or a bad idea, really, I don't know. We can't talk about that tonight, but it's important that we try to see what we could do with these proposals that are before us, and whether it's really almost the end of the line, folks. Your leadership won't, some of the ecumenical leadership won't say this, but it seems to me it's almost the end of the bilateral era. We've had such good talks and we've had written reports. Is there some level of agreement, at least on the ELCA side, that we could now harvest in? But let me tell you what I think the real future of ecumenism might be for Lutherans like the ELCA and the LCMS trying to recover being churches in mission. I think it would go in a different way. I think we'd learn from others, but we'd learn something slightly different from what we've been fixated on in the last round of dialogues. Let me try to play this out with a couple sets of neighbors. We've had a very good time with Roman Catholics. It's just still remarkable. For all that I may talk about a frieze that's there, if I think of the world in which I grew up and in which many of you grew up, that Lutherans and Catholics could be such good friends at this point. I team teach a graduate course with a distinguished Franciscan colleague at the GTU, and we love to do each other's parts, you know, really just I'll do all the Vatican II stuff and he'll do all the Barton Tillich, and, you know, it gets very confusing to the students because they don't know quite who we are yet, and, you know, they'll start calling me Father Lull, and I'll say, well, that's, I don't object to that, but no, that's him. We've had a wonderful time with Roman Catholics. I have my own reservations about whether in the current chill it's the right time to lift these ancient condemnations, not because I'm particularly happy about them, but I'd like that to be more of a mutual thing than I think it's likely to be. I'd like to have a sense that we're not in a mood of utter reaction, but in a somewhat hopeful time. But we'll see. There'll be an important debate. But you know what we really got fixated on in the dialogue with Roman Catholics is teaching authority in the church. Because, boy, if we've had trouble with that, they've had that in spades. And, of course, we had to talk about that. And we went through infallibility. And we went through the papacy. And then we went through infallibility. And we said a little bit. And nobody liked it very much. And we didn't come together. And some of our leading theologians think that if we don't get a kind of Roman structure, it's all over for us. But I think that's not in the cards. And I've come increasingly to think for a church in mission, it's not even the right thing for Lutherans to be learning from Roman Catholics. That's going to be a tough one. For us ever to say, yes, this kind of structure. I mean, our Lutheran vibes will and ancestors will have to be very distant memories for us to say, yeah, that's fine. But there's something far more powerful that we could learn from Roman Catholics that would be helpful right now. And that's how to have the self-confidence to do mission in infinite cross-cultural settings. Because when we Lutherans were beginning to tear each other apart in the 1560s and 1570s and having to try to put it all back together with the formula of Concord, the Roman Catholic Church was already engaged in wonderful ventures of mission in Latin America and in China. Now, believe me, folks, I've read the history. I'm not naive. I'm not saying that was all good or that we'd want to emulate every part of that. But here's a church that's been far more imaginative and has a longer history. We had one big burst with mission around pietism. And since most of us aren't pietists these days, we can't do it that way. We can read it with a certain kind of appreciation, but we're not driven by the same hopes and fears that those folks were. I'd predict the future of ecumenism on this side is a shift of conversation away from a structural issue that we really can't solve at this point to something where we really could sit as Lutherans at the feet of some Catholics and be instructed. Even now, when I visited India, it was amazing to see the capacity of the Roman Catholic Church to enter into a culture where they do not feel at home and find their way to do some of that stuff with world religions that we Lutherans are really just beginning to work on. Let's take the evangelicals. Is there a group that we resent more for coming in and doing our stuff and getting everybody for it? And now some Lutherans are saying, lots of Lutherans are saying, well, we ought to learn from them. If we did what they do, we could do church growth and maybe we could have at least half the success that they've had. Do it if you want to. I'd certainly want to learn about it and being curious about what they're up to. I wouldn't dismiss it that because it's done by evangelicals, we couldn't learn anything from it. But I don't think that's what a Lutheran church in mission is going to get the best help from on evangelicals. You know what I think we need to have the humility to do? To go to the evangelicals and say, help us figure out how to sustain the kind of remarkable interest in Bible study and Bible literacy that you have and we used to have and we don't have anymore. I mean, it's impressive. Generally, when I get or other seminary professors get a Lutheran student who's biblically literate, after I'm able to say after a couple of weeks, when did you leave the evangelical church and become a Lutheran? Now, it may be different in your place. You may resent what I'm saying because you may be teaching your heart out around it. But I have to say, when I look across the whole country, we're barely able to claim our heritage at that point. And it ought to be possible to look, not to say everything the same way we'd say, but to say, how do they get ordinary folks interested? How do they get people to come? We've decided in most of our churches there's no interest in the Bible. Well, you'd never know it to look at lots of the churches in our towns, just among Lutherans, that there's no interest. Let's take Episcopalians. Haven't we admired not only their classiness, but their liturgy? And rightly so. The Book of Common Prayer is a remarkable thing, one of the greatest documents of the last 500 years of Christianity. And by the way, not a mean theological achievement either. To say all they have is liturgy is to be very naive about what liturgy is. There is packed into the Episcopal Prayer Book some wonderful and rich theology, including some of the best lines of Reformation theology that were ever said. I bet Luther in heaven wishes that he had written Cranmer's prayer, "We do not presume to come to this thy table, trusting in our own righteousness." That, boy, as long as a church is praying that prayer, there's something deep and powerful about the grace of God that's at place. We ought to celebrate, as we've been doing with Episcopalians, how much we have in common, how relatively few quarrels we've had through the years. But do you know what I admire about the Anglican tradition? Probably the thing that you think is the most compromised in it. And that's that they're very diverse and they have learned to accommodate each other. Yeah, we all know about the High Church Episcopalians, and we all know about the Evangelicals, who, by the way, in England are by far the largest and most influential group, and we all know the kind of broad church Anglicans. But this, I mean, they've had their battles, folks, particularly on the ordination of women. But I think on the whole, they're a lot more successful at living with the fact that there are other kind of people around who are members of their church who are not like them, and they're probably not going to be able to convert, no matter how many nasty editorials they write in theological journals. Sometimes I think we're an awfully immature church. And my guess is part of the shock of the ELCA merger was to find out how really different we are from each other. It may have been pretty gentle in the Northwest. But I think when we read the Lutheran and see how diverse we are all around the country, it's very, very difficult. My guess is that we could be really snotty and say, well, we are held together by the Book of Concord and all they have is, you know, liturgy and some bishops. One of the things they have we haven't taken nearly seriously enough is a spirit of self-restraint that's willing to acknowledge that people who are quite different, to use an old-fashioned term, in their churchmanship, still are part of their family and their team. And if we're going to survive, either as the Missouri Synod or the ELCA, on into the future, there's going to have that ability to say, you know, so-and-so is not my cup of tea, but he or she may well be God's cup of tea. So I think I'll hold my tongue. There, as I've said, a very un-Lutheran thing to do. Well, I've talked about the Catholics, and I've talked about the Evangelicals, and I've talked about the Episcopalians. What about the other mainline churches? What do we usually want to learn from them? Nothing. We're afraid we're getting a disease from them. We're scared to death that their present is our future. And it may well be, to some extent. But you know what strikes me, folks, that we could learn, and it's only one of many things that could be listed. One of the things I admire about the Presbyterians and the Methodists and the Disciples and the American Baptists, and yes, dare I even say the dread United Church of Christ, they've lost a lot of members and they whine about it far less than we do. It's really interesting. Now, you probably got some Lutheran defense that's able to say, well, that's because they're so spiritually dead, they don't even care. I wonder, folks, God's been awfully generous to us. We've not had either in the Missouri Synod or the ELCA the kind of falling away. We've had our financial struggles. They've been peanuts in comparison to those other churches. And yet I think we've complained probably 7 to 8 times as much about how it's the worst of times. Could it be that some of the churches that we look down on as, oh, we thank you, God, that we're not like them, and please let's not get too close in the future, could it really be that the Spirit does some things in them that would actually be quite instructive for us? I wonder. I think it's time to shift some of the... to say one more thing ecumenically, folks. I really think we're moving into a post-ecumenical age. I don't mean an anti-ecumenical age. I don't mean back before the dialogues, but one that is much less driven by a sense that we're coming together institutionally and corporately. Part of what that means is nobody's got to be desperate to fit into somebody else's agenda. It means to me partly Episcopalians don't have to pretend to be very enthusiastic about justification by faith, because I don't think they are really. And I don't think we have to pretend to be any more enthusiastic about bishops than we are, present company excepted. But my guess would be, if we're all now together in this new mission situation with so much of our society alienated from Christianity, we might want to restart the dialogue around some other points that would be driven not how can we get enough agreement that we can all reluctantly admit that we're alike, but where do our different histories really offer an opportunity for us to help each other with this mission challenge? My mother's been dead for 10 years. I think it was 10. Yeah, it was 10 years ago this spring, and I have frequent conversations with her. They've gotten more and more frequent as the time has passed, since it was fairly clear that this was not mental illness, but the kind of thing that happens with the passing of time. And some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. Goodness, my father's been dead for 20 years, and we, 30 years. 30 years, could it be? 30 years, and we chat all the time about things. But my mother had such vigorous ways of going at things, and we had so many disagreements and so much love that it's particularly fun to talk to her about matters involving the church, in which she was as full of opinions and self-confidence as any person in this room. And how she loved the Lutheran Church, which she came into as an adult, and how she worried at any wavering in what she had received in adult instruction. She hoped that she had gotten it right now, and that the church was not about to blow the heritage that she'd come to appreciate so much. She called me back before a year or two before her death and said, there's this commission for a new Lutheran church. And I said, yes, that's right. She said, you're not on it, are you? And I said, no. And she said, just as well, I don't like the sound of it. And I said, well, now, Mom, we've talked about this, and you're ALC and I'm LCA, and we've been trying to get... Oh, she said, I'm not opposed to that. I just don't like the sound of this new Lutheran church. She said, remember, Tim, what I really like to sing is my church, my dear old church. Any of you know that? Oh, that's not going to be in any future hymnal, probably. A lot of fun to sing it. I love my mother, but I want to disagree with her on this. It is a dangerous hymn to sing, because it makes us think that the continuity that God offers us is in the form of the church, and it sets us up then for anxiety and failure and disappointment in every generation. It's just theologically not true that the church is unchanging. Anybody who's been through catechism knows better than this. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. And if you'd like something that's the same yesterday, today, and forever, that role is taken not by the church, but according to the Epistle to the Hebrews, by Jesus Christ. We've really gotten confused between what we're comfortable with or what we would like and what God may be doing. I have to say may, because God's ways are always hidden, and they're not certainly any more revealed to me as a seminary professor than they are to you where you sit. I have a sense that the right note about the church for our time would be sounded more like a passage by a passage like this if we wouldn't be insulted by it, if we would see that it was just not a description of those fools at Corinth. You remember that congregation that got almost everything wrong, probably the only congregation worse than the one that you're serving or used to serve. But if we would see that this is probably a pretty good description of us too. Consider your call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. That's a kind of sobering assessment of our qualifications, isn't it? But there's promise here. There's good news here. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to reduce to nothing the things that are, so that no one might boast in the presence of God. It's that same old Pauline argument about boasting and justification, isn't it? And woe to us if we think we're going to find justification in the church any more than we're going to find it in our own good works or the intensity of our own religious experience. Thanks for the chance to share these reflections with you.